Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, everyone, welcome back. Hamish Hodder.
Hello.
He's back again. What's cracking?
Oh, not much. Another week has gone by. Another exciting week where we're 1 week Insightful. Closer. We're 1 week closer to something.
Yes. Of course we can talk about it. So I guess like everybody knows about this already.
This is not
finalizing the details and yada yada. So I didn't want to absolutely bank on being able to tell everybody that yes, this was happening, but we're very excited to say that we are once again going to the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting in Omaha, and that is not this weekend, not the weekend that you are listening to us, but it is on the 6th of May and we will be there. So hopefully if you are making the journey across to Omaha from wherever you may be, hopefully we'll see you there. And if you see us, for sure, come up and say hello. We're very happy. Like when we're there, when we're out in public, when we're there at the Berkshire meeting, we are more than happy to have a chat to everybody and see what's cracking. Mm. Last year was pretty crazy, actually. That was definitely mind blowing.
Yeah, there was.
When we went there.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was so nice. We met. Not sure if we met anyone who was listening to the podcast specifically, but certainly people who followed our channels. It was incredible. Yeah, so where if you see us, don't be shy. Feel free to come and say hello. It's the perfect time to do it. So I'm looking forward to it.
And what you're going to see on our channels. And also on the podcast over the next few weeks while we're in America. So we're actually going for how long? 3 weeks?
Yeah, just about 3 weeks. Yep.
So we're going to be in Omaha for a bit, obviously making a lot of content around the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting. Then we're also going to Colorado for a bit and we'll be in Denver. And then we are going to Las Vegas as well for a music festival that's happening there. So chances are you might see us around if you're in any of those states. But what I was getting at is that all of this whole trip that we're going on, the Berkshire Hathaway 2023 trip, is going to be sponsored by Seeking Alpha. So you're going to be seeing over the next few weeks a lot of our content across YouTube and across the podcast as well will be brought to you by Seeking Alpha. That starts next week, so I won't harp on too much about it right now.
Yeah.
But we are very excited to actually have a major sponsor for this event, this value investing event, and it's going to be powering us to make a lot of content while we're over there. So we're super happy that they're on board, super happy that they saw kind of our vision and what we wanted to do with this trip and the content that we wanted to make. It's just so cool that, you know, this is crazy. We've got a major sponsor for a Berkshire Hathaway shareholders trip.
Yeah.
That's epic.
Yeah. Well, because this kind of came up probably near the start of the year where we started to kind of work through this. And yeah, it was certainly something I hadn't thought was something we'd be able to do until kind of you brought it up. So yeah, super exciting. That 1 week in Omaha, we're going to be cranking out as much content as possible. And some of it will come out that first week. And then, you know, some of it will be spread over, the remaining time while we're over in the United States. So, there's going to be a ton of content. Make sure you're following us on all channels. And
yeah.
I'll be trying to post a bunch of stuff on Instagram. So go follow us on Instagram. I'm sure Brandon will be as well. If you want just some, informal day-to-day stuff.
Yeah. If you want to see the day-to-day stuff, definitely Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely Instagram. We super appreciate you guys showing us the love and support, especially for the sponsored content across the next, say, month or so. Because at the end of the day, like it's ultimately, it's your support that enables this sort of stuff to happen. And we're super, super thankful for it. We absolutely love your support. Thank you very much for giving us all the views and the watch time, all the minutes that you spend listening to the podcast, just everything. We really appreciate it because it's your support that does make this kind of stuff happen.
Yeah.
So we're really, really thankful for that.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. All right.
Okay.
Yeah. What have we got? We've actually got a pretty jam-packed episode for today. We've got continuing. We're into week. Well, it's not week two of earnings, but it's week two of us covering earnings.
Close enough.
Week two of earnings we care about. We've got the two big advertising giants as some of the most interesting and most followed businesses, Google or Alphabet and Meta Platforms. So we'll take a look at the earnings of those two, compare how the both of them are kind of performing given the tough, you know, macroeconomic environment and how that's affecting the advertising market. We have Australian inflation data came in, so we can take a look at how inflation is progressing in Australia. It's been quite high for a while. We got blessed with a brand new Peter Lynch interview from CNBC, which is a rare occurrence. I mean, we're talking about, you know, it's rare that we get an interview from Warren Buffett, but even rarer is Peter Lynch.
I have to go back a couple of decades for Peter Lynch's last interview, I think.
He doesn't do them very often. I think, he's done a couple of Charlie Rose ones, like maybe every once a decade or something like that. But then most of the interviews are, you're right. They're a lot older, a few decades old. And then what else have we got here? Elizabeth Holmes. That's a story about Elizabeth Holmes.
Yep. Elizabeth Holmes, somehow she stays out of jail.
Oh, really? Wow.
It's very impressive.
I'm interested to hear that because I haven't been keeping up with that. So lots to talk about today.
Lots to talk about, Hamish. So over to you. Yep. Let's get this thing rolling.
Today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. So you can bring in all of your trades either automatically by connecting your brokers, super easy, or you can just download your trades using Excel and import them, or you can enter your trades one by one if you want to do that. And when you do that, it will track all the gains and losses in your portfolio. So capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans, it will do those calculations for you. Currency gains, if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies. And then you can also use ShareSite for when it comes to tax time. So ShareSite generates up to 12 different reports that can be used at tax time to work out things such as capital gains, dividends, and income, and more. At the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/young investors. That's site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSite.com/young investors. So use that link. You can sign up to a free plan and track up to 10 holdings for as long as you want. Or you can also use that link to sign up to a premium plan for more features. And if you do that and use our link, you'll get 4 months off an annual subscription. It's a great deal. Go check it out if you haven't already. Even if it's just the free plan, go try it for as long as you want. And as always, thanks to those who have signed up to ShareSite through our link and are supporting the podcast.
Mm. Absolutely. All right. Hamish, hotter. Where are we going to start? You pick.
I think we should start with, let's start with some earnings because it's always kind of fun to go back and forth between Alphabet and Meta Platforms. Of course, they're the two global digital advertising giants that make up the vast, vast, vast majority of the online digital advertising space. So it is always kind of interesting to see how they're performing, especially since it's been tough for advertising, you know, relatively speaking, given everything that's going on. Businesses tend to, you know, when they're looking to cut expenses, advertising is usually one of those areas they can save a bit of money relatively quickly when they need to kind of save some money. So it's always interesting to kind of take a look at them. I'll start with Google if you...
Okay, sure.
And then we can kind of... I think you've gone through Meta, so we'll kind of go back and forth.
Yeah. I think normally this is a bit interesting. I think I've covered Google for the past like few quarters and you've covered Meta. So now it's flipped. Yeah. It's the other way around. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. So revenue for Google came in for the quarter at $69.8 billion, which was up 3% year over year. So not much growth there, although pretty similar story to many global businesses. If you take out the foreign exchange impact, they grew by 6%. So, businesses that are earning a lot of revenue in foreign currencies, especially the euro and a couple of currencies where there's been quite a big shift, then once it comes back into US dollars, it doesn't contribute as much to growth. So 6% growth.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think I say this all every quarter, but it does kind of blow my mind that they do $69.8 billion of revenue in 3 months.
Yeah.
3 months.
Like $22 billion in a month.
It's unreal. It's so, so much money. Yeah. Anyway, it just always blows my mind.
Imagine making $1 billion a day. Like it's kind of, they're not quite there, but it's...
But it's probably some bit. I don't know. I'm not sure what businesses would be there, but there'd be a few.
Yeah. And I mean, Q1 is, you know, seasonally quite, low for advertising businesses. So I'm sure they probably do more than a billion a day in the fourth quarter. I'm not sure exactly off the top of my head, but yeah, probably close to that. But of course, Alphabet is now this, for a while it's been this, it's had a number of business segments through which it generates revenue, although most of it is advertising. Google Search was the biggest piece of the pie still, which came in at $40.4 billion, which was up 2% year over year. So pretty, you know, slow, consistent growth out of their core Google Search advertising business. YouTube it came in at $6.7 billion, which was down 3% year over year. So, yep, that's been a couple of quarters now where YouTube has been kind of down a little bit, a little bit compared to the last year.
I guess that kind of makes sense where people, when you Google search, people still want to rank. Like Plumber, Canberra, you know, they always want to rank up top, but maybe more of that, what you might say brand advertising that you'd see as a, you know, pre-roll on YouTube, maybe more of that gets cut back, like drink Coca-Cola, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's definitely one element of it. And there was kind of two things, but that was one of them that they spoke about on the conference call.
Yeah.
And the other one is interesting, and I actually hadn't really thought of this, but it makes sense, is there has been quite strong demand for retail and travel. And retail and travel leans more onto Google search than it does onto YouTube. So again, kind of speaks to
interesting.
What you were just describing, which is there's some brand retail and travel advertising, but a lot of it is direct marketing where you're searching for a particular store or a particular type of clothing, and the retailers, you're right, they want to rank, you know, up the top.
Interesting.
So that's been a bit of a spread there. And then what I found really curious was the Google network marketing revenue, which was $7.5 billion, down 8% year over year, which is quite a big drop. Quite distinct from Google search and YouTube. And Google network advertising, for those who don't know, is the advertising that Google does on individually owned third-party websites. So if you just set up a website, you can put, you know, little Google advertiser banners there, and Google will serve kind of ads that way. But I thought it was quite interesting that the Google network advertising had such a different outcome to Google search and YouTube. Unfortunately, they do talk about it on the conference call. So Ruth Porat, the CFO, said it essentially reflects continued advertiser pullback, which has been happening on both YouTube and Google Network. But since Network has much more of a diverse mix of businesses, it's being more affected than YouTube. So, and again, that speaks to what you just mentioned, which is YouTube has a lot of big enterprise brand clients that their spend is very consistent, like Coca-Cola and Apple, whereas the network marketing is a lot more, a bigger mix of kind of small, medium and large businesses. And as a result, the kind of that mix of businesses have been pulling back on advertising much more than some of the big names that have these kind of very big big deals with YouTube for just consistent billions of dollars worth of brand advertising.
Interesting. Makes sense.
Yeah. So those are kind of the advertising units of Google's business. In total, Google's advertising revenue was $54.5 billion, which was flat year over year. So some parts were up and some parts were down. Then we have Google Other, which kind of includes YouTube premium subscriptions, their Play Store sales and that sort of thing, all of just kind of the other Google bits, the hardware sales, which is still a very small part of their business.
People paying to integrate Google Maps into some website or some integration, all that sort of other shit.
Yeah, Google Other is the right way to label that category.
Yeah.
So it came in. I mean, it's a small category, but it's still a lot of revenue, $7.4 billion, and was up 9% year over year, so continuing to grow. Google Cloud, which is, you know, again, one of their smaller businesses, $7.5 billion, but was up 29% year over year. So cloud continues to be the place where most of the growth is coming from, although it's not contributing to too much overall growth for the Alphabet business because it is still quite a small business unit. Then we have finally Other Bets, which is their kind of speculative research and development companies, which produced $288 million of revenue, down 35% year over year. But that kind of fluctuates up and down depending on, you know, what projects they're kind of launching in that small, very small segment.
Nice.
Yeah. So that kind of reflects the revenue segments. I thought I'd spend a bit of time talking about YouTube because they spoke about YouTube a little bit in the conference call. It was kind of a point of notice. It continues to be an area where Google believes they're going to be able to drive a lot of growth in the future. So they spend a bit of time kind of focusing on the performance of it. According to Nielsen, YouTube advertising return on investment, so for advertisers, is 40% higher than linear TV and 34% higher than all other online video. So that just speaks to not only is online video advertising far more effective than linear, but Google is very, very good at doing it compared to other platforms, say like Twitch, for example, would be another platform owned by Amazon that also does video advertising. But it is kind of incredible, 40% higher. That's not a small margin. That's a considerable reason for advertisers to pull their money away.
I guess it makes sense because still when you're thinking YouTube, yes, 99 times out of 100 when you see those skippable ads, you're just waiting. You're waiting for that button. You go boop. But I guess at the same time, at least the ad is right there on your device and all you have to do is... and you've gone to their website. Whereas when it's on the TV, just watching TV, you then have to go get your phone and look up and go from there. So it does it does make sense why it's more effective. But I didn't know it would be like 40% more effective. So
yeah,
that's pretty. And 34% higher than all other online video.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's crazy. That kind of shows you that even when you take out the effect of having to get your phone out versus it being right there, even the boop, they're so much more effective of getting the click.
Yeah. It does just speak to how much data Google really does have. They have the most by far in terms of first-party data, in terms of, you know, other companies can collect data from tracking you through websites and that sort of thing. But in terms of the data you give to Google, they have the broadest data because you do most of your searching online through Google. So they have they know every single thing that you've searched for. And that kind of builds a picture or an advertising profile of who you are. How many times you go to Sportsbet, you're going to get Sportsbet ads. No, but it's...
bullets of sweat. Yeah.
No, so it is very interesting to kind of see that. And they actually measured that not just in the US, they measured it across 16 different countries. So this is not a US-based thing. This is, Google is very, very good at advertising, which is, no surprise to anyone. And then beyond advertising, they spoke about they're continuing to expand their subscription offering. So YouTube Premium continues to have kind of more features built into it. It's always been kind of ad-free and now you can queue different videos in and have downloads and that sort of thing. So that's kind of their main YouTube subscription. They have YouTube TV and YouTube Primetime Channels, which are their kind of cable bundles, online cable bundles, competing against the cable companies. And they've continued to expand those at a considerable rate. And then YouTube's main platform, so not their cable network business or anything, just the YouTube videos on their main platform, continues to capture the largest individual share of viewing time in the US, which is now 7.8%. And not only do they capture the largest share, 12 months ago, their share was just 6.7%, which is a massive jump. That's that's over one percentage point in market share that they've gained over the past 12 months. So not only, of course, are people spending more time online, increasing the overall usage, but YouTube's share has been increasing. So, and just for a side-by-side comparison, Netflix, which is kind of their biggest competitor for time, their market share has been flat over the past 12 months. So YouTube has been a clear standout among all of the different kind of video, online video consumption options in that it is still gaining more and more market share, which is of course good because they can put more advertising.
Nothing much to add there, although one thing that just came to mind when you said when you were talking about YouTube Premium, so one hack that Claude taught me is that YouTube Premium and Spotify Premium, they're like the same price.
Mm.
YouTube Premium, if you sign up, you get YouTube Music, which is essentially just like Spotify, but you don't get ads.
Mm.
So you get a Spotify Premium equivalent, but you also get no ads on YouTube.
But you don't get Spotify Wrapped at the end of the year. You can't brag to that you spent 50,000 hours during the year listening to music.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I've listened to Who Let the Dogs Out more than anyone else on this earth.
That's one thing I don't understand why more social platforms I don't know why more social platforms don't do that, because I find it really interesting. Yeah. I'm a stats guy.
Give you
guy.
Some cool stats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I want to know. Stats. Give me some. I want a YouTube one. Like, give me like what categories I watched and depress me by how much time I spent on the platform.
Yeah.
And you're
even like just random funny stuff. Like imagine like Facebook or Messenger giving you stats at the end, where it's like, this is how many hours you spent with the chat box open, but you weren't actually pressing a button.
Yeah. Like, this is how many messages you typed and deleted.
Yeah.
This is how
many characters you've punched into your phone over the last 12 months.
Yeah. This is how many girls you messaged who didn't reply.
Oh, Hamish. No. It's all right, buddy. They will. Just keep trying. Keep trying.
Okay. It's keep mostly trying. Just you.
Okay.
Brandon, please talk to me.
Where are you? Oh dear. All right. What have we got more to talk about for Google?
We've got a little bit more. Costs, so traffic acquisition costs is kind of their bulkiest expense. It came in at $11.7 billion, which was down 2.5%. So interesting to see acquisition cost go down, even though revenue was flat, which is quite good for the business. They spoke a bit about their layoffs. Of course, they've been leading the charge among the big tech giants, laying off a lot of people. They had $2 billion in severance and related charges in the first quarter, which is a lot to pay to lay off people. And then on top of that, they spent about $550 million on reducing their office space. So, they've been downsizing. Although not really, their headcount still rose year over year from 164,000 to 191,000. So,
interesting.
Yeah, interesting to see that.
You know, one interesting thing I saw. Maybe you guys saw it floating around in the media this week. There was catching headlines was Sundar Pichai's compensation package. Ooh, did you see it?
I didn't see. No.
Yeah, it's...
Was it good? he's like one of the top paid just, executives.
Yeah,
I feel like he was making... 2000, like, yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, 2022, he made $226 million.
Yeah, that's quite something. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can see why people are getting a little bit frustrated by it, though, because he was like, in January, he wrote a blog post being like, it weighs very heavily on me and I take full responsibility for the layoffs that are happening, but we just have to lay off 12,000 people. I am incredibly sorry. And it's just like, and by the way, we could have retained some of you, but instead I'm actually going to take home $200 million. So it's a little bit, you can understand how people are a little bit frustrated by that. Seems a little bit hypocritical. Actually, another funny one was Ruth Porat, who's their CFO, wrote out a company-wide email saying about how they're going to be cutting back on laptop replacements, staplers, and tape.
Right.
And she took home $24 million last year.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Like, I don't know. Can't the tape be on you, maybe? Ruth, come on.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, Google has one of the most outrageous stock-based compensation expenses out of any company I've ever seen.
Yeah.
They had, during the quarter, it was about $5 billion in stock-based compensation across the whole company in a quarter. Right. So you're talking about close to 20, if not more than $20 billion in stock-based compensation.
It's big bucks.
Being paid out every single year. And this CEO is doing quite well
Yeah. I should say that the CEO stock award thing is, what do they call it? Triennial, once every 3 years. So this is an abnormally large year, but even still, if you space $226 million out over 3 years, it's still absurd.
He's doing pretty well.
Yeah, I'm making a video on it about it right now because CEO compensation is just ridiculous. I think in 2021, CEO to regular worker compensation hit 399-1. Actually, I should look that up because I've got all the stats here. It's absolutely crazy. In 2021, the ratio of CEO to typical worker compensation was 399-1. In 1965, it was 20-1.
Wow.
So still a lot more, but
that's crazy.
A lot less than 399-1. And here we go. I got some stats for you. So this is just in 2022. So Tim Cook, and by the way, all of these companies have announced layoffs to some extent. Tim Cook, he took home $99 million. Satya Nadella, Microsoft, $55 million. Reed Hastings, your mate, $51 million. Zuck, $27 million. Bob Chapek at Disney, $24 million. Daniel Shulman at PayPal, $21 million. Guess how much Elon Musk took home?
Zero.
Zero. Yeah, I knew you'd see through that one.
Poor guy. Not at
all. But yeah, interesting. Anyway, sorry, I'm dragging us so far off topic right now.
No,
it is an interesting discussion when we get onto CEO compensation. But anyway,
yeah,
back on track.
Yeah. So then overall, operating income came in at $17.4 billion, which was down 13% year over year. So they did end up seeing a decline in operating income, but also not particularly surprising given everything that's happening. And then in terms of allocating capital, they continued to allocate a very large portion of their free cash flow towards share repurchases. And a lot of the share repurchases are just offsetting the stock-based compensation, because of course, as they do stock-based compensation, they're issuing a bunch of shares, so they have to do share repurchases to kind of offset that. But net of stock-based compensation, they repurchased $9.3 billion worth of stock during the quarter, which is
a decent chunk
of stock. And that's it. That's all I had for Google's earnings. So pretty good overall. Obviously, you know, reflecting the slowdown in advertising, but not a bad quarter if that's a, you know, if that's a bad quarter, that's pretty good.
If this is a full recession and their revenue is just kind of flat year over year, then sure, take it.
Yeah, yeah.
You want me to roll on into Meta?
Let's do it.
Well, here's the headline for Meta. Similar story. Meta shares pop 12% after company reports first year-over-year sales increase in four quarters.
Wow.
Issues optimistic guidance.
There we go.
So, it's pretty crazy that this shit. Actually, I was going to talk about this later, but I'll talk about it now. I have just been not paying attention really to the share price of Meta. Meta was $90 per share in November. It's now $209.
Yeah.
And that's before. It's also gone up 11%, 12% after hours.
Yeah.
And it's up 130% in just a few months.
Yeah. I mean, the swing has been crazy. It was like, what, $350, I think, a share? Down to 90, which is an enormous, collapse. And then now, it's very quickly recovered in the last, 6 or 8 months.
Reminds me of what Peter Lynch, I know we'll talk about this, but he said this in the recent interview that we're going to talk about. He was like, when a stock goes from crappy to semi-crappy, the stock goes up. When it goes from, semi-crappy to good, the stock price goes up. When it goes from good to great, it goes up. So it must be that tipping point where it's kind of gone from to like, oh, hang on, it's not that bad, and it's still kind of trending up. So anyway,
interesting.
Let's talk about it. So revenue was up 3% year over year from $27.9 billion to $28.6 billion, although costs did rise from $19.3 billion to $21.4 billion. So overall operating income was down 15% year over year to $7.2 billion.
Right.
They did note that revenue, like what we were saying before, revenue would have been up 6% if calculated on a constant currency basis. So again, that wouldn't have been too bad for their revenue growth. They also noted that restructuring efforts cost $1.14 billion in the first quarter of 2023, saying, quote, as of March 31st, 2023, we have substantially completed the 2022 employee layoffs while continuing to assess facilities consolidation and data center restructuring initiatives. In March 2023, we announced three rounds of planned layoffs to further reduce our company size by approximately 10,000 employees across the family of apps and reality lab segments. In connection with these layoffs, we expect to incur total pre-tax severance and related personnel costs of approximately $1 billion, of which $523 million was recognized during the first quarter of 2023. The remaining charges will be substantially recorded by the end of 2023. So a lot of that kind of layoff cost is already baked in to the numbers.
Interesting.
But sorry, back on track to their financials. So we spoke about revenue. Revenue was up 3%, up 6% if you go constant currency. They did have their operating income down, and that meant that their operating margin has dropped from 31% to 25% year over year.
It's almost almost identical to Google. 3%, 6% was exactly the same, and then Google was down 13% on operating income, whereas Meta is down 15%. So it's pretty much
tip for tat. Identical.
Mm.
Interesting. Oh, hang on. Oh, this is, oops, no. imagine if I don't Google as well.
And their YouTube segment. So
yeah. Oh, dear, that would be a blunder. Luckily, that is not the case. Okay, net income is down 24% year over year to $5.7 billion, so they took quite a hit to net income. Although they did note in their report that cash equivalents and marketable securities were $37.44 billion as of March 31st, 2023. Long-term debt was just $9.92 billion as of March 31st, 2023. And I was actually looking, so they've got just in cash, short-term, marketable securities, $37 billion. They actually only have $25 billion of current liabilities, just full stop.
It's pretty
so
handy.
All of their current liabilities for the next 12 months can just be covered with cash or basically cash equivalents. So pretty handy. Like when you're talking about recessions and what we should look out for, I mean, something like that is pretty comforting to know that, look, just the cash that they've got sitting in the bank can cover the next 12 months worth of their liabilities. That's pretty sick. I like that.
Yeah, it's pretty rare as well. You know, we try and look for companies, and a lot of companies will have current assets in total, also short-term assets above current or short-term liabilities. But yeah, it is a different level of comfort if they don't even have to convert, say, inventory or receivables into cash in order to cover their obligations. They're just completely covered with cash, which is, this is very, very rare.
Yeah. I'm just having a look for Google as well. So Google have $115 billion in cash and short-term investments.
Mm-hmm.
$115 billion, and they have $68 billion in total current liabilities. So Google in much the same situation. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So pretty crazy. It gives you a lot of comfort as a shareholder for sure.
Yep.
Knowing that, sky could fall and we're probably, like you can never say for 100% certain, but we're probably going to be okay.
Yep.
Now I've lost my doc. All right. Back at it, Hamish. Back at it. Operations-wise, is that all? Yes, operations-wise, family daily active people averaged 3.02 billion in March, up 5% year over year. 3.02 billion.
Still going up.
Are using one of Facebook or Meta's apps every day. Family monthly active people, so same metric, but just once a month as opposed to every day, was 3.81 billion, up 5% year over year as well.
Crazy.
So it's a boatload of people. Facebook daily active users, so just the Facebook app, was at 2.04 billion, up 4% year over year. Facebook monthly actives were 2.99 billion, up 2% year over year. Then we get to the juicy stuff, Hamish, the stuff that we're interested in, ad impressions and price per ad. So in the first quarter of 2023, ad impressions, so the amount of ads that got shown, delivered across our family of apps increased by 26% year over year.
Mm-hmm.
However, the price, the average price per ad decreased by 17% year over year. So you got your sliders, more ads going out to the world, the amount that they're collecting for each of those ads, 17% less year over year.
Yep. And there's one big driver that's doing all of that, and it's short form, reels. Far more ads you're going to see as you swipe in your finger. But those ads are far less effective, so they get bid. they don't get bid up as much when advertisers are competing for them. So, continuing to see what we've seen for, I don't know, the last 8 quarters or so with short form.
a long time.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly right. So talking about headcount was 77,114 as of March 31st, 2023, a decrease of 1% year over year.
Interesting.
Substantially all employees impacted by the layoffs announced in November 2022 are no longer reflected in our reported headcount. In terms of share repurchases, so we repurchased $9.22 billion of our Class A common stock in the first quarter, so $9 billion of share repurchases there. As of March 31st, 2023, we had $41.73 billion available and authorized for repurchases.
Mm.
So, again, depends on what your valuation comes to and whether it's smart for them to repurchase stock or not, but definitely, what was their stock at? $90 per share? I mean, you could make an argument that pretty smart to be buying back your stock around there.
Yep, for sure.
Sinking another, $40 billion into repurchases now that your stock's high again? I don't know, but depends on your valuation.
Yeah.
What else? Yep, I spoke about that before, talking about this stock. Yes, and what people are really happy with is that they guided for second quarter 2023 total revenue to be in the range of $29.5 billion to $32 billion. So taking the lower figure there, that would still represent 2% revenue growth year over year. So investors are I think the story is investors are basically going from extreme pessimism, where they think just the sky's falling and they've seen negative year-over-year revenue growth for the last 4 quarters, to now they're just like, oh, hang on, is it as bad as what we think? A little bit of optimism, year-over-year revenue growth this quarter, guided for year-over-year revenue growth next quarter. So maybe there's some level of optimism coming back in, and that's what we've seen in the share price as well, as it's kind of scooped up.
It's pretty common. You'll see that analysts kind of just extrapolate the last few quarters into the future. So whether that's extrapolating growth or extrapolating further declines. So yeah, whenever there is a turnaround, I mean, we saw the same thing with Netflix, where they lost subscribers for a couple of quarters. And as soon as they gained subscribers, the stock just reversed course because, you know, after a couple of losses, analysts are just projecting further losses, which, isn't, it's amazing they get paid to do that. But anyway,
bet they do, and here we are.
Yep.
Okay. Just a couple of things from the conference call. I didn't listen to the whole conference call. I just listened to basically what Mark was talking about. So they said that Reels is growing on Facebook and Instagram, and people are resharing Reels over 2 billion times per day.
That's crazy.
2 billion Reels being...
I contribute my fair share to that, of that.
You do. We love. I love sending you Reels, and you send them back. It's great. They believe they're gaining market share in short form. They can't confirm, but they believe so. So take out of that what you will. This is actually quite interesting. More than 20%, this is what Mark said, more than 20% of your Facebook and Instagram feed is now fed to you by AI from pages and people that you don't follow.
Okay. Interesting.
There you go. 20%. Which is kind of interesting. I mean, I don't really like it. I just want to see what, you know, my mentality is, oh, I like their content, I follow their page. I don't like their content, I don't follow their page. I know there's a million pages out there, many that I've not seen before, so fair enough that they want to try and dish me something. But I don't know, I've always just been a little bit like, why? Why are you just trying to send me stuff that I just don't follow? But there you go.
Yeah, it is weird.
I think it's a trend that's only going to continue. Just AI feeding you what they think you want to see.
Yeah. Well, on YouTube, I don't know about you, but I never search for videos. It's always recommended, right? The recommended tab is very, very good at kind of showing you things you follow or things that are very similar to what you follow.
Yes.
But yeah, with Instagram, for some reason, I just want to see the people I follow. I get kind of annoyed when I see a lot of kind of branding stuff on Instagram. Because I guess you do just have a lot of pages that are brands, which is obviously fine, you know, promote your business, but it is a little bit different to YouTube, where people might be promoting their brand, but it's, you're getting, you know, some other kind of content out of it other than just the advertising. But I don't know. It's confusing. I've certainly,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like I follow Formula One. I would much rather see a Formula One post than whatever this Taylor person's, you know, hanging out in the Bahamas. Like, I don't care. I do not care.
Yeah.
I'd much rather see what, you know, Lewis Hamilton or Max Verstappen are doing on the F1 grid.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe it's just infancy. Maybe it's early stage. Maybe it'll get better. Because you're right. The YouTube recommended tab works very, very well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then again, that's showing you, you know, I guess it's showing you everything, what you subscribe to, what you've been watching, Anyway. Moving on. Since they launched Reels, AI recommendations have caused a 24% increase in time spent on Instagram.
There you go.
Pretty strong argument for incorporating AI into your business.
Yep.
Reels monetization efficiency is up 30% on Instagram and 40% on Facebook quarter over quarter. So nice. AI getting a little bit stronger. Reels monetization is a little bit better.
Yep.
They also note that daily revenue from Advantage Plus shopping campaigns is up sevenfold in the last 6 months. So Mark spent a fair bit of time saying that, you know, we're investing heavily in AI and it's starting to pay off. It's a long-term thing, but it's starting to pay off. We are seeing some very impressive growth metrics from our implementation of AI into our apps.
Interesting.
Interestingly, they did a study with UC Berkeley. I don't know how much you can read into that, a Facebook-sponsored collaboration with UC Berkeley, but Mark said that for every $1 spent on ads, it drives $3.31 in revenue for advertisers in the US.
That's crazy. Yeah,
that's pretty favorable, isn't it?
That's pretty good. And again, it speaks to kind of the other stat from Google about how effective ads are for return on investment versus, you know, linear. Digital advertising has just been a beast for businesses, and you know, some businesses are doing everything online now, and others have got to work through a transition from a lot of traditional media. But it's an ongoing process, and it's certainly not finished.
Yeah, and then the last thing I had to say was the rumors that they're moving away from the Metaverse project and Metaverse investment is simply not true. It's a long-term project and they are committed to it. They are gearing up to launch their next generation consumer VR/mixed reality product later this year.
That's so exciting.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always interested to see kind of what they're launching because, they're spending a lot of money and I want to see what they've got.
What are they coming up with? Yeah. Come on.
Come on. You don't have a full metaverse by now? Come on. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to take some time.
And that's Facebook. That's Meta. That is their earnings. So a bit of a mixed bag. You can, you know, optimists can look at it optimistically. Pessimists can look at it pessimistically. But it seems like they're just kind of turning back on the uptick a little bit.
Yeah.
Long way to go, but
we'll see. Definitely seems that way. So, yeah, interesting to see.
All right, talk to me, Hamish. Peter Lynch, hey? How good?
Yes.
We got a Peter Lynch interview. How good?
We did, and it wasn't, you know, it's not a Warren Buffett 2.5-hour interview, but we got a few minutes of Peter Lynch, which is great. Always interesting to hear from him. He's a very, like, funny, kind of charismatic guy as well. He always chucks a few interesting jokes into his his spiels on investing principles. It was only 11 minutes, so he didn't speak through kind of too many topics, but he kind of reiterated a lot of the principles that he's kind of spoken about over the years, especially around kind of his core kind of investing philosophy, which is kind of buy what you know. This idea that, you know, people are so careful about what they buy, kind of plane tickets and booking holidays. Like people are so careful, they're comparing prices, they're looking for the best deal, the best bundle. But when it comes to stocks, people will just kind of hear a stock tip and throw money at it rather than, you know, carefully considering it, which is definitely true kind of, I guess, for, you know, the general population who may not kind of care too much about the stock market investments. It's kind of the case.
He definitely had that. You could even pick up a couple of things that he said during the interview that was like kind of plucked. You know, he's got like a 1 hour or 45 minute keynote in his brain that he just plucks stuff from. Because I reckon he's given that keynote hundreds of times probably. And like that's what the Peter Lynch videos on YouTube are about. So he draws like the same kind of examples. It's like people buy a refrigerator.
Yeah, that's
they do their research. They buy a plane ticket. They do their research, and then they'll hear some stock tip from John on the bus, and they'll sink $5,000 in it.
Yeah,
but no, he was definitely talking about the importance of knowing what you own, particularly in a time like this. And he took it one step further to be like, yeah, know what you own, but don't just like be able to have a one pager on it. Don't just be able to explain to a young kid why you're buying the stock, why it's going up, but also like take the time to really read over the financials. And even what we're talking about before with the advertising giants, it's just like one of the most important things you can do, particularly in a time of recession, kind of like right now, is just look at how much cash they got and how much debt do they have. And I think his example is something like, you have one company that's got a lot of cash and no debt, nice. If you got one company that's got no cash and a lot of debt, not nice.
Yeah.
It's like even pushing it to it doesn't have to be like, I think Peter's very much of the opinion, it doesn't have to be overly complicated.
Yeah.
But even just like looking at that, those kind of basic metrics are going to help you out a lot in this kind of environment where things are a little bit shaky.
Yep. Yeah, 100%. He spoke, kind of continuing on, he spoke about, looking for something different. So it's a business with a good story, and it has to be kind of, it has to have something different. So he talked about kind of two types. One is, a company that's going to do well over the next 5 years. So a company that's kind of on the rise, or companies that are turnarounds. So, but generally speaking, in both circumstances, you're talking about a business that's out of favor in some way.
I was just going to say, in his book, One Up on Wall Street, he basically, there are six types of businesses that he talks about. There's fast growers, stalwarts, slow growers, cyclicals, turnarounds, and asset plays. So I think it makes sense anyway that he's saying you either look at the fast growers or you look at the turnarounds. It's like it's either the companies that are just growing really strong, regardless of like recession, doesn't matter. We're growing so quickly, it's fine, whatever. And we're going to be way further along in 5 years. Or you look at the turnarounds. Like most companies have been pegged back a little bit by, economic environment of the last year or so. So, and he was talking about how important it is to look for that inflection point where things do start getting better. And he's saying, even right now, you can make arguments that there are a lot of positives in the economy. Things are kind of starting to turn around. And he was saying that if you can really watch for that inflection point with a turnaround, with a stock that's been pulled back, but because of the nature of Wall Street, right, and institutional trading, things get oversold. Like they just get cut and the share price plummets and the big funds are out of there.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you get that inflection point where things start to get better, well, they all come back in and then they have the opposite effect. The stock shoots up. And that's why what I was saying before, he spoke about how when the stock goes from super crappy to crappy, the stock goes up. When it goes from crappy to, decent, it goes up. When it goes from decent to good, it goes up. When it goes from good to great, it goes up. And he was saying the only time you should really worry is when a business is just like at the peak of its game doing fantastic, Web3 companies selling pictures of gorillas for millions of dollars each.
Yeah.
Because like at that point, there's probably only one way to go, right?
Yeah. I think he was like, if it goes to great, terrific, get out. Like that's the time to get out.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because, we've spoken about this a little bit. You kind of get all of these different kind of, they're all kind of value investors in a way, but long-term investors, but you do get these kind of different approaches. Peter Lynch has his own approach where he's looking at, much smaller companies with long runways, and he's potentially getting in and out of these companies. So if things are looking overly rosy, get out. Or you have, a Charlie Munger where you could say, Costco has been in a very rosy position, very high stock price, but he just continues to want to hold that business. So you kind of get these little differences. It is always interesting to me to listen to a variety of investors and make my own mind up about, which particular principles I want to follow.
Yeah, for sure.
What else did he talk about? He kind of said, he had an interesting quote. He was like, it's always darkest before it's pitch black, which is kind of a twist on the normal phrase, obviously, which is the idea that things can always, even when things look really bad for a company, they can get a lot worse. So his approach has been to wait for things to get better in a way. Wait for some kind of sign, as you were saying, with the kind of inflection point. Wait for things to look a bit better. Don't be, don't catch a falling knife is probably the other way that you could put that phrase.
Yeah, definitely.
he then kind of spoke about, you know, if you need the money in the next year, then it's not going to be worthwhile investing, because the next 1 or 2 years is always going to be a coin flip. And that's, you know, always been true across time, but especially given the uncertainty at the moment, really nobody has any idea what the next couple of years will look like. There's just so many factors. We don't know what inflation's going to do, where interest rates will be, what the economy's going to do, what, you know, geopolitics is going to do. There are so many kind of things bubbling up, even like internal conflicts in the US between political parties. There's so many things just kind of bubbling around that you think of all of the things that we can't even name, you know, things like the pandemic that we couldn't have named before it happened. There's just always things that are happening and that can affect the next couple of years. So if you're investing, you've got to have that kind of long-term mentality. And really, like we said, you know, look for those companies that have strong balance sheets that can survive through some kind of tough period.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of good little things in there.
Yep.
Do we have any? They were probably the main points. The main any other points?
That was pretty much.
I mean, only an 11. We've probably spoken about this interview for longer than the interview actually went for. It was only 11 minutes or so. But yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of stuff. Buy what you know. Make sure you're really looking into the financials. Watching the balance sheet. Not gambling. Thinking about the long term, thinking about long term investing, looking for things when they're getting better. I guess that kind of stuff. They're probably my main takeaways.
Yeah.
Anything else that you can think of?
No, I think that's just about it. Feel free to go and check out the full interview. It's on. It'll probably be on CNBC's pro website, I think.
Again, it is behind a paywall.
Yeah.
It's a bit annoying.
Yeah.
However, if you watch our YouTube videos on it, you'll basically see the whole thing.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
Where should we go from there? How much time have we got?
We got about 8 minutes left. So should we talk about, I'll just fly through this Elizabeth Holmes stuff. There's really not much to add.
I'm really interested to hear this.
However, she has avoided going to prison for now. The article reads, disgraced Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes will not go to prison this week, despite a judge's order that she begins serving her 11-year sentence on Thursday. Late Tuesday, Holmes' attorneys appealed that ruling to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. Under the court's rules, that means Holmes will remain free on bail for now. Holmes, 39, has two children, the first of whom was born before her fraud trial in 2021. The second was born after her November sentencing. Like, regardless of what you think about Elizabeth Holmes, for the kids, man, that must be tough. Must be so tough. Imagine, like, having your mom there. And it sounds like these kids, clearly are very young. And then, bang, your mum's gone to jail for 11 years.
Yeah.
I'll catch up with you guys on your 13th birthday.
Yeah. It's also kind of weird that she, I don't know, each to their own, but why would she have a second child when she was probably going to go to prison? Like, she had the second child just, like, last year. So, it's kind of a weird...
Sure, there could be a lot of potential explanations. But, yeah, you're right. You would be like... I would be like, oh, geez, I'm going to prison. Do I really want to have another child?
I don't know. But even so, it's weird that, she was sentenced in November, but then, she didn't have to go to jail until April. This month was when she was supposed to go into prison. So even that is weird to me. I don't understand how you can be sentenced, found guilty, sentenced, and then they're like, oh, just report to us in 3 months. Like, is that normal, or is that because of the specific circumstances of the case? I don't know. Now she's going to appeal it. So she'll, be able to survive another year or so, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. In November, a U.S. District Judge Edward Davila sentenced her to 11 years and 3 months in prison. Holmes' attorneys asked that she be allowed to remain free on bail while she appeals her conviction. But earlier this month, Davila denied that motion and ordered her to report to prison by April 27.
Wow.
In their last-minute appeal, Holmes' attorneys said Davila's ruling contained, quote, numerous inexplicable errors. They say she should be allowed to remain free while she appeals her conviction because the appeal is likely, quote, likely to result in a reversal. The government has 10 days to respond to the motion. Holmes' appeal of her conviction filed last week argued that Holmes could not have knowingly misrepresented her supposedly revolutionary blood testing technology to investors because she genuinely believed the product worked. quote, highly credentialed Theranos scientists told Holmes in real time the technology worked. Outsiders who reviewed the technology said it worked. Theranos' groundbreaking developments received many patents, the appeal said. Her attorneys argued that the government's case, quote, largely parroted the public narrative, first laid out in a series of negative Wall Street Journal articles posted in 2015 that Holmes knowingly committed fraud. So, see what happens, eh?
I guess we'll see. That'll be kind of insane, yeah, if she doesn't end up serving any prison time. Because
I don't know. Sounds like a last ditch effort.
It does. But, I mean, of course, they're going to exhaust all of their appeal options.
They will. Which is why you pay lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. You're not gonna just turn down any options to try and appeal. So, I guess we'll see. But she'll survive another year or so. I guess
she'll survive. Well, I think she'll survive in prison, Hamish.
She'll
live to fight another day outside of prison.
Yes, yeah, with her freedom. No, but it is interesting because she was. This all kind of collapsed so long ago that I think she'd only have a couple years left if she'd just been serving in prison the entire time, which will be kind of ironic if she ends up going to prison for 11 years. It's like, well, you could have just sat in prison this whole time and it would have been done.
It's interesting. How would you... Okay, Hamish, you got to go to prison for 11 years. Sorry, buddy. It's 2023.
Yeah.
You know you've committed fraud. Like, you know you're in trouble, right?
Yeah.
Right? Okay. What do you do? Do you go, all right, I'm going in right now, 11 years, I'm out. I'm getting it over and done with. Or do you go, I'm young now, I'll push it as far as I possibly can through the legal system. I'll probably still go to prison and then I'll serve my time later when I'm a little bit older.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously don't go to prison.
Like, what do you do?
You obviously stay out because you don't know if you'll...
Okay.
Because, I mean, if you get found innocent then
that's true.
You've just wasted time in prison.
Good point.
So, of course, she has to stay out, but it is just kind of ironic that so much time has passed that she would have been out if it had been like a quick process.
Was this 2015? It's been like 8 years.
Yeah, 8 years. So give it another year, 9 years. She would have had kind of two left if she'd served it immediately.
Crazy.
That's not how the court systems work. Things take.
It's pretty
time.
Crazy how that. Like, I don't know. I don't really know much about the U.S. courts, but it is pretty crazy, in my opinion, that this can just be dragged on for so long. I mean, because it's clearly tactical. Like, there's no arguing the matter. It is tactical to try and draw it out for as long as possible. Surely there should be a law, be like, this needs to be resolved within the next year. Done. Go.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know anything. So there's probably perfectly legitimate reasons why that can't happen. But you know.
Yeah, they just need more judges, more lawyers.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably. All right, Hamish, should we do just a couple of Q&A questions and then bounce out of here?
Yeah, I'll ask this one to you. Thinking about the latest Warren Buffett movement in Japan, how can we track super investors' buy and sells outside of the US, like the sort of 13F filings, which are for US trade?
Personally, I think we're probably going to be the same. I think the best way... or the easiest way we do it is just through ticker. Do you use ticker still for that kind of stuff?
Yep.
Yeah. So ticker is just a website you can use. They sponsored a video of mine once, although this is not sponsored. It's basically like, as well as the 13F filings, they also comb through like company filings, reports, other 13F equivalents from around the world to kind of... to try and get a better picture of the total scenario of someone like Warren Buffett. So yeah, you can definitely go like that. Yeah. Otherwise, you can like look through. I know it's not helpful if you're trying to find out what stocks Warren Buffett potentially holds, but if you know that he holds one, you can sometimes go to corporate filings and he might be listed under their major shareholders when they list that in their corporate filings. So you can see how much he owns there.
The only thing I'll add with ticker is you can go on ticker and you can look at Berkshire's all of the investment that Berkshire owns, but Berkshire is also a holding company of subsidiaries. So sometimes he does something cheeky, which is he'll buy the shares through one of the wholly owned subsidiaries. So for the Japanese investments, if you're looking for them, you have to look for the investment vehicle is called National Indemnity Investment something, something, something. So if you look through there, then in ticker, you'll see the Japanese filings. You won't actually see them listed under the Berkshire overall holdings. So
cheeky Buffett. Yeah,
a little bit of a sneaky move.
Stop being so cheeky. All right. Let me ask this one to you. What should one look out for to avoid stocks like Netflix mentioned in, I think it was the Guy Spier video.
Yes.
I think we're talking about, you know, companies that still rely on the capital markets to bring in more funding because they have negative cash flows.
Yes.
It says, do we simply look at operating cash flow? What percentage of cash flow is considered good? I'm new to investing.
Yeah. So
what do you think?
Yeah. So what Guy's really talking about is we want to invest in companies that are very cash flow positive. So their normal operations can fund their investment opportunities. And he used Netflix as an example because during, I think it was 2016 to 2020, they had a consistent process of being, they were very cash flow negative and they were taking on a lot of debt. So you can look at the kind of the cash flow statement and you can see, okay, their operations, they're negative. And so if they're losing money, how are they funding that? You can go a bit further down on the cash flow statement and you can see, okay, they took on $5 billion in debt, $7 billion in debt. And you can see, okay, they're actually using outside funding. So we want companies that don't need to take on debt or issue shares is another way that companies kind of get access to more capital. But generally speaking, you can also just kind of look at the first part of the cash flow statement and look for positive operating cash flow. Netflix, I think I would probably disagree with Guy's kind of characterization of it because they're a little bit different in that they all of their content spend comes out of their cash from operations, whereas to me, some of that is investing. So in other words, there's some unique cases now with internet companies where they'll actually be able to technically invest through the income statement. Amazon is one of these companies who's had basically negative earnings for, well, not now, but they had negative earnings for a very long time. And it's because they're able to essentially effectively invest through the income statement, whereas typically that's not the case. So there's some unique kind of nuances depending on the businesses. But generally, you want, you know, very cash flow positive businesses that don't rely on debt, essentially.
Nice. Very good, Hamish Hodder. All right, that is us done for the day. Thank you guys very much for tuning in, and we hope that you enjoyed the podcast. And of course, if you wanted to ask us a Q&A question, you can just head to the most recent YouTube version of the podcast and you can drop us a comment, or you can go to Spotify, and if there is a question box there, you can chuck your question in there.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, we are getting ready to go to America soon.
We are.
Next week's podcast will be recorded just before we get on the plane.
Yep.
So the night before, which will be very exciting. So we're very excited for that. We'll talk to you guys more about that next week. So I think that's it from us for now.
Yep.
Thanks very much for joining me, Hamish. Thanks as always to ShareSite for sponsoring. We'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.